So the last talk of this morning session is by Ségolène Meillac. Ségolène works both at the Institut Imagine here in Paris and at the Pasteur Institute. And she's going to tell us about the making of the heart.
So I will go on by, so I'm very happy, thank you very much, Denis, for inviting me to this symposium. I feel a little bit like an outlier because my expertise is really more in the in vivo mechanism of morphogenesis, but for the sake of the presentation today, I will try to make some connections with published work from other laboratories trying to develop cardiac organoids. Okay, so to tell you about the formation of the heart, I want to start about the function of the heart so that we can understand the principle of morphogenesis and what is important in the mechanism of morphogenesis. So classically, the heart is thought as a pump, so the contractile function is very important for the function of the heart, but equally important is the function of the heart in establishing the animation is not working, but it's not a great deal, I guess. Sorry. To adapt. Blocked. I am blocked. Okay, let's start this. Here we go. So equally important for the function of the heart is the double blood circulation. So the heart is separated into two halves, one which contains the oxygenated blood and propels it to the organs, and one which collects the carbonated blood from the organs to send it back to the lung. And this is a very important function of the heart. And sorry, I'm probably messing up the button of this. Last trial, I promise. Okay. So the congenital heart defects are the most frequent congenital defects at birth. They affect about 1% of live births, and they are a leading cause of death in utero and before the first year of life. And we can classify congenital heart defects into two categories, the cardiomyopathies, which are the diseases of the myocardium architecture, so for example, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and dilated cardiomyopathies, and relevant to the other function of the heart in the blood circulation are what we call the structural heart defects, in which there are misalignment or misseptation between the different cardiac segments. For example, in double outlet right ventricle, you have a connection between the left and right side of the heart, leading to an overall poorer oxygenation of the blood. And in transposition of the great arteries, you have an abnormal connection of the aorta, which is normally connected with the left ventricle, and in transposition of the great arteries, it's connected to the right ventricle. So these are really severe cases of heart malformation which need to be repaired at birth. So what I want to tell you today is insights of what is necessary to make a heart to sustain these different functions. And I will divide my presentation into three parts. How we can produce a contractile myocardium, how we can form a tube in which the blood will flow, and how the tube needs to be remodeled to establish a double blood circulation. So the functional unit of the heart is the cardiomyocytes, which is a cell type dedicated to the contractile function, based on the sarcomere, in which you have a sliding of actin and myosin filaments, which sustain the contraction. So in cardiomyopathies, so the diseases of the myocardium, of the cardiac muscles, they are associated genetically in human with mutations in components of the sarcomeres or in structures which will couple the cardiomyocytes to one another to ensure an efficient contraction between cells. So how the cardiomyocytes appear during development. So they appear very early, as soon as the heart forms. So I will refer to the mouse as an animal model. So at the stage 8.5, which is equivalent in human to the fourth week of gestation, you have cardiomyocytes which are formed. So you can distinguish in red some organization of the sarcomeres, and the cells are initially rather rounded. But during the course of development, the cells will reorganize, they become more elongated, and the sarcomeres are aligned along the main axis of the cells. And in addition, individual cardiomyocytes are precisely connected to one another, so that you have an overall alignment of the contractility along the tissue. And this association of cells form what is called myofibers. And then now at the scale of the organ, you can see the precise orientation of these myofibers. And if you look along the wall of the myocardium, you will see that there are variations in these orientations. So the colors indicate different orientation of the fibers. So for the myocardium, it's not enough to have contractile cells. It's also very important to have a cellular architecture to sustain the efficient contraction of the heart. So what's going on in vitro models? It happens that it is very easy to produce cardiomyocytes in vitro, probably because this is one of the first cell types to differentiate in the embryo. So for a long time, people have identified a cocktail of factors, and you still see the usual suspect, Wnt, being involved to form cardiomyocytes. And this is how these cardiomyocytes look like. With some sarcomere organization. But these sarcomeres and these cardiomyocytes are not very mature, so don't contract very efficiently. And there has been recent development in the laboratory of Gordon Keller to try to promote higher maturation of the cardiomyocytes. And he's been able to do that by adding to the culture medium some factors which will act on the metabolism of cardiomyocytes. So he has added components to work on PPAR signaling, as well as triggering hormone stimuli from steroid or thyroid hormone. And when he does that, you can appreciate the higher maturation of cardiomyocytes and higher organization of the sarcomeres within these cells. So these are 2D cultures. So what's going on then when the cultures are done in 3D? Because in vivo, the myocardium is organized and has a shape. And in chambers, for example, you have a layer of myocardium which is covered internally by a layer of another cell type, the endocardium, lining the blood cavity. So in 3D cultures, and playing with a different cocktail, you can generate from the pluripotent stem cells not only the myocardium here in green, but also the endocardium here in purple. And these cells assemble in something which is a chamber-like structure in which you have a cavity, and the myocardium is lined internally by these endocardial cells. So we can reach some sort of cell organization in this 3D culture. But for the heart to be functional, you need to have blood flow inside. And the way the embryo does it is by forming a tube. So these are representation of the heart at different stages of mouse development. So this is the heart as you know it at birth, with the two atria and the two ventricles. But when you look earlier in development, you can still distinguish the two atria and the two ventricles, but you can appreciate that this structure is mainly a tube, a tortuous tube at this stage. And earlier on, when the heart initially forms, so in the E8.5 embryo, so this is the embryo here within the yolk sac, you can see this structure here, which is the cardiac tube. So this is now a schematic representation of the cardiac tube. The cardiac tube is functional when it forms. So the red cells are the myocardial cells, they contract. And the blood flows from the venous pole towards the arterial pole. The way the tube forms is by elongation, by recruitment of precursors, which are localized around the heart tube in pink here, a region which we call the heart field, the field of progenitors. And earlier on, you can see the beginning of the differentiation of cardiomyocytes in a shape which is called the cardiac crescent, which forms along the formation of the gut. So this is why in organoids, so now we are looking at not organoid, but gastroloid, so models of the whole embryos in which you have not only cardiac cells, but other cell types, and in particular, gut cells. So when you look in gastroloid, you can see that you can generate cardiomyocytes and that the pattern, so in this paper, they describe this organization as a cardiac crescent, and in this alternative paper from a different group, they describe this organization as a heart tube. So indeed, if you compare with the schemes I've presented you before, these structures look quite similar. But if you look a little bit more closely, in vivo, the cardiac crescent will point towards the anterior of the embryo. But curiously, in this organoid, the cardiac crescent was oriented towards the posterior of the embryo. And for the tube, you can distinguish a very similar shape, but it looks like it's more the contrast is not very good. The rest of the gastroloid is here. So you can see that this tube is more a diverticulum, though there are some bifurcation here, which could be reminiscent of this. This is a dead end. So I'm not really sure how reproducible these structures are and how functional they are. And I think we should be cautious as well, you know, not to try to force these patterns that we see of cardiomyocytes, because we try to make sense of this organization and make sure that this is not pareidolia, so trying to make sense of these patterns. In vivo, the way the heart tube forms has a very precise choreography, which has been reconstructed in Spain by the lab of Miguel Torres, and who has been interested in understanding the transition from the cardiac crescent to the heart tube. So in red, you see the cardiomyocytes, and in blue, you see the precursor cells from the heart field. So in the crescent, you will initially see that there is a bulging, which will elongate into a tube, and this is now the dorsal view. The tube is initially formed ventrally, and we will close progressively dorsally. And I hope the movie will play so that you can see it in vivo. So this is the cardiac crescent here. You will see how progressively you will have some bulging of cells here, which will form a tube. And dorsally, you will see that the tube is closes progressively. So this is the heart tube. You see the movement indicating that it's beating. And this is how the tube forms in vivo. So as you can see, the formation of the tube is tightly correlated with the heart field, which is represented in blue, and I will give you a closer look on this heart field, which is schematized here. So it's a field of cells which is very precisely organized in an epithelium. We also call this the dorsal pericardial wall. And as the cells differentiate, they go in a transition zone where they start to express markers of the sarcomeres, for example, typical markers of the myocardium, but they also experience a change in the cellular architecture. The transition zone is highly cohesive, and so overall you have a coordination between the differentiation of the cells and the morphogenesis, the tubulogenesis. And one particular aspect is that the cells which are undifferentiating, they abut the endoderm, and when they form the tube, they will detach from the endoderm. So this is something that you can see here in these fluorescent images from the lab of Shankar Srinivas. You have the myocardium here in green, and if you do a section here, you will appreciate that this myocardium is detached from the endoderm layer, whereas the heart field, which is here, is still abutting the endoderm layer. And why I'm telling you that? Because when people have plated the stem cells under confinement, so using a circular micro pattern, they have seen something which I found interesting, which is the detachment of these myocardial cells from the dish compared to the red cells, which are less differentiated. So we know now how to form a tube, but a tube has a single blood circulation. So the next question is to understand how the heart can establish a double blood circulation. So an engineer, I guess, would come up with an easy solution. You can just bisect the heart tube in two, and here you go, you have your double blood circulation. This is a solution which is partly adopted in vivo, because when we track the cells of the different compartments of the heart, we find indeed that there is a bisection of the tube in the inflow and in the outflow. The problem comes with the ventricles, which arise in series rather than in parallel along the tube. So that to reconstruct the double blood flow, it is absolutely essential to remodel the shape of the heart tube so that you can align the pieces of the puzzles together. And my laboratory is very interested in the mechanism driving the tube remodeling and how these mechanisms are potentially involved in congenital heart defects. So to address this question and follow the mechanism of heart tube remodeling, we have to reconstruct this shape in 3D, and one technique that we use is high-resolution episcopic microscopy, in which we image, so the tissue is being sectioned, but instead of imaging the section, we image the surface of the block so that we have a perfect alignment of the different tissue sections to reconstruct the 3D shape. And after segmentation, we can extract, compared to the reference axis, the notochord, the shape of the heart. You will see in yellow the outline of the myocardium, which will then appear alone, so that you can appreciate the shape of this heart tube. So from this 3D reconstruction that we've done actually as well at a later stage, so the heart tube is transformed, the remodeling is like this. So the heart tube is transformed from a straight tube to a helix, and you can appreciate the 3D shape of this helix with a lot of different levels of curvature. So we really need to analyze this shape in 3D to understand how it is built. And so we did some measurements during the course of the process called heart looping. So when the initial heart tube is transformed into a helix, you can see that this is a process during which the ventricles, which are initially anterior and posterior, are repositioned where they should be on the right and left side of the embryo. So the question we ask is what is the mechanism of this process of massive shape changes during heart looping? And this project was led by Jean-François Le Garec, who is in the audience, actually. And with a physicist eye, he decided to quantify the elongation of the heart tube, taking the center of gravity of the tube, comparatively with the distance between the poles of the heart, so the arterial pole and the venous pole. And during the course of heart looping, what he observed is that there is a massive increase in the tube length, 4.4-fold, but this occurs at a time when the distance between the poles remains fixed. So this indicates that the tube is growing, but it has no space to elongate. So necessarily, the tube will have to deform, which is a process which is called buckling. So this is an easy way to generate a complex deformation. But of course, buckling by itself should be a random deformation. So there are other components which are important to make sure that we have a robust helix which is generated. And by combining additional observation, Jean-François designed this predictive model of heart looping, in which we have as an input the elongation of the heart tube between the fixed poles, so the buckling mechanism, which is modulated by the fact that I told you the tube is closed dorsally and this closure is progressive. So when the tube is still attached, this creates a mechanical constraint to the tube. But when the tube closes, so the dorsal attachment is broken down, this will release the mechanical constraint. And to make sure that the buckling is not random, we observe that there are asymmetries at the poles of the heart, rightward rotation at the arterial pole and an asymmetric ingression of cells at the venous pole. And when we input these three parameters together, you can see that the model can explain how we can generate a helix from a straight tube, and how during this process, the ventricles, which are initially anteroposterior, can be repositioned on the right and left side of the embryo. So we have a mechanism for heart tube remodeling, and how the next question is how this relates to congenital heart disease. So I want to take two examples during the end of my talk. The first example is the heterotaxy syndrome, in which is associated with left-right anomalies. So in the heterotaxy syndrome, you have left-right anomalies of the visceral organs in terms of positions or shape or asymmetry. And heterotaxy is associated with severe congenital heart defects, in which, for example, you have malposition of the ventricles or the great arteries, and you have problems in the segmentation between, in the septation between the different cardiac compartments. The genetics of heterotaxy syndrome is fairly well known, and one of the genetic variation is associated with nodal signaling. And we know that nodal from mouse model is important for heart looping, so we decided to investigate how nodal can regulate heart looping. So first, nodal is expressed very transiently in precursors of the lateral plate mesoderm, and as you can see, very strikingly, only on the left side and not at all on the right side of these precursors. But when the heart tube forms, nodal is repressed. So to understand how nodal can play a role in cardiac cells, we used the classical trick of genetic tracing. So we used a transgenic line in which the asymmetric enhancer of nodal drives LACZ expression instead of nodal, so that we have a more stable expression and reporter of the cells which have expressed previously nodal. And as you can see here, in the heart tube, the cells which have expressed nodal do contribute to the heart tube, but they mainly contribute to the poles of the heart, the arterial pole and the venous pole, and not at all to the ventricles. And in sections, you can see that this contribution is asymmetric, so they would contribute to the left side of the outflow tract, and they would contribute to the left atrium and not to the right atrium. So nodal is expressed transiently in the precursors of the heart tube pole. So then we wondered how nodal can affect heart looping, and so we first looked at the buckling mechanism, which we think is very important for heart looping. And so we quantified in nodal mutants the tube lengths and the distance between the poles, but we found no significant difference. So the tube length is not significantly different in nodal mutants compared to control, and the distance between the poles is not significantly different in nodal mutants compared to the control. So we conclude from that nodal does not affect the buckling of the heart tube. So in keeping with the contribution of nodal expressing cells to the poles of the heart, we hypothesized that nodal might play a role in the asymmetry at the poles of the heart. So one way to quantify this asymmetry, and in particular I will show the example of the rotation of the arterial pole, is to compute the angular difference between the left side and the right side. So this is the heart tube here, and the rotation is seen as an angular difference on the left and right side. So we can quantify this angular difference along the axis of the tube. So you can see the situation in controls, that you have an angular difference at the arterial pole, but not at the venous pole. And when we look at nodal mutants, we made two observations. One is that there is randomization of the orientation of the asymmetry. So some mutants will do the rotation on the right side, but some others will do the rotation on the left side. But in addition to that, if you compare the blue line and the black line, you will see that nodal also regulates the intensity of the asymmetry. So nodal is required to orient, but also to amplify the asymmetries at the poles. So what is the consequences for the shape? When you look at the shape of the heart tube in nodal mutants, we found four different categories of abnormal heart loop shape. This is not a continuum. We've done the quantification of the shape, and we can see that these categories cluster individually. And these classes are equally frequent. So we can use statistics to show that it's a randomization. So this is one example of a random event. And why now we have four classes, our explanation is that this is because nodal will regulate independently the asymmetry at the arterial pole and at the venous pole. So if you have two possible orientation in two locations, this makes four possibilities. But in addition, we have to take into account that nodal will reduce the intensity of the asymmetry. So if we input these conditions in our model, we can generate these different heart loop shapes, and we have a very good correlation in terms of ventricular orientation between the simulation and the observation, as you can see here. So nodal is very important to pattern the precursors of the heart to orient and amplify asymmetries at the heart tube poles. This is a graphic summary. Nodal is transiently expressed to regulate asymmetries at the poles, which are important to shape the heart loop. And at a transcriptomic level, what we found is that downstream of nodal signaling, by transcriptomics in mutant, we found a deregulation of cell genes involved in cell proliferation, cardiomyocyte differentiation, and extracellular matrix composition. So nodal is required in the precursors to modulate this very classic behavior with the consequence on the shape of the heart tube. So this is how the tube loops with a repositioning of the ventricles. So now at the end of the heart loop, the ventricles are positioned on the right and left side. So what one could think that this is sufficient to establish the position of the ventricles until we found a new mouse mutants, which is a mutant for this gene Greb1L that I will come back later. And in these mutants, we have a normal heart looping. The right ventricle is on the right side and the left ventricle is on the left side initially. But one stage later, we observed a very striking repositioning of the ventricles, which somehow reversed to an anterior posterior position. So this was very intriguing how this can occur. So we decided to investigate what's going on in this mutant at a morphological level and then at a molecular level. And what we could see is that together with this change in the ventricular orientation, we have two other features. One, which is that the outflow tract is shorter in the mutant compared to the control. And the other observation is that if you take a closer look at the atrioventricular canal here, in which normally the valves will form in a structure at this stage, which is called the atrioventricular cushion. So these cushions are normally parallel to one another. But in the mutants, we found by 3D reconstruction that the cushions are now spiraling around one another, which is indicative of a torsion at the level of the atrioventricular canal. So we did some correlation between these parameters, and I will show you here the correlation between the length of the outflow tract and the orientation of the right ventricle, left ventricles. So even though we are in an in vivo situation, we have some variations in the shape that are plotted here by these individual points. And if we can quantify these variations in shapes, we can get insight into potentially the mechanism and the correlation between these different parameters. So in the controls at E9.5, which is represented here in light blue, you have a certain length of the outflow tract and certain orientation of the ventricles. And when the embryo grows, you have in particular a growth of the outflow tract length, which is associated with the maintenance in the ventricular position. But in the mutant, at E9.5, they start in a position which is very similar to the controls. But during 9.5 and 10.5, there is a complete arrest of the growth of the outflow tract. And this correlates with the change in the ventricle position with a very high coefficient. So altogether, what we've been able to show by this 3D quantification of the heart loop shape is that the growth arrest of the outflow tract but also a reduction in the pole distance are predictive of the ventricle position in Grebe-Wanell mutants. So what we think is going on is that compared to the normal situation when the E9.5 heart tube will grow homogeneously, in a mutant, there is an arrest of the growth of the outflow tract, and this will create a mechanical constraint which will pull the tube, which will, as a consequence, undergo a torsion at the level of the atrioventricular canal, which will result in the misorientation of the ventricle. So it's initially an arrest of the outflow tract, but a mechanical impact on the shape of the tube. So how can Grebe-Wanell regulate this? Grebe-Wanell is a poorly known gene, no known protein domain, so we had to start from the very beginning and first assess where is Grebe-Wanell expressed. So we did this in 3D by a whole mount RNA scope, embryo clearing and light sheet microscopy, and you can see that Grebe-Wanell is, for example, expressed in the neural tube, but it's also expressed in the cardiac region. So to see this a little bit better, we segmented the cardiac region, so you will see appearing very soon the segmentation of the heart tube in red and the segmentation of the heart field in white, and this is the signal within this segmented domain. So we found that Grebe-Wanell is expressed very early on at E8.5, and it's more intensely expressed in the field of cardiac precursors compared to the myocardium, and this is the fold difference between the heart field and the heart tube. So again, like for nodal, we have a gene which is very transiently expressed in heart precursors and before the formation of the heart tube. So what is Grebe-Wanell doing? For this, we used transcriptomic analysis, and we cross-correlated two kinds of analysis. One analysis in a available published data set in wild-type single cells, where we correlated the genes which tend to be expressed together with Grebe-Wanell, or on the other hand, anti-correlated. And the other transcriptomic data set is the traditional comparison between controls and Grebe-Wanell mutants. And by doing this, we identified two sets of genes, some genes which are anti-correlated with Grebe-Wanell in controlled cells and tend to be upregulated in the mutants, and these genes tend to mainly be enriched in the gene list associated with cardiomyocyte differentiation. And in reverse, we found a gene list which tend to be correlated with the expression of Grebe-Wanell and are downregulated in the mutants. And these would correlate with the GO-terms associated with ribosome, and more specifically with ribosome biogenesis. So our final model is that Grebe-Wanell is very important to pattern the heart field and to regulate the supply of progenitors. In Grebe-Wanell mutants, we have an exhaustion of the progenitor field because cells prematurely differentiate, and also because they have reduced ribosome biogenesis, which is classically associated in other tissues with the reduced proliferation. This is something we are directly testing now. And as a consequence of the lack of progenitors, there is a growth arrest of the outflow tract, which then will exert some mechanical constraints, which will completely reshape the heart tube with a torsion at the level of the atrioventricular canal and a repositioning of the ventricles. And this is interesting because if you look at the phenotype at birth, this mouse model reproduces a congenital heart defect, which is known as crisscross heart, a very rare defect, and this is the first mouse model that we have identified, which permits to understand the embryological and genetic origin of this defect. So in crisscross heart, the diagnostic feature is that there is a cross of the blood flows compared to the normal situation, and this arises because of this twisting at the level of the atrioventricular canal. And this is associated with supero-inferior ventricles, so the abnormal position of ventricles, and it's also associated with malposition of the great arteries, which is in keeping with the defects in the growth of the outflow tract that we have seen. So to finish, how the organoids can help us to understand these complex congenital heart defects, because at the moment we are not yet there that we can first produce a heart tube and then analyze the remodeling of the heart tube. But what the organoids are very good at is to show the timing and the sequence of differentiation from pluripotent cells to heart precursors and to cardiomyocytes. So this is an example of by qPCR of these dynamics of cell differentiation, and we can see with markers how these cardioids would first express markers of the first heart field, like HAND1, then markers of the second heart field, TBX1, followed by expression of early cardiomyocyte marker like ACTC1, and later cardiomyocyte marker like MIL2. And we can even plot in this diagram the expression of GREB1L, which you see is specific to the precursors. So this will provide us a tool to try to assess in more detail the mechanism of GREB1L during the course of cardiomyocyte differentiation. This is work for the future, and potentially, as Anne has nicely shown, how this compares in mouse cells with human cells. So in conclusion, I have shown you that in vitro we can generate the differentiation of cardiac cells, in particular the cardiomyocytes, but not only. And if we play with culture conditions, we can see some self-organization. And in vivo, our work on the quantitative analysis of heart shape in 3D and with a temporal time window was able to help us to understand how crucial the patterning of the heart field is, not only to generate cardiomyocytes, but also to shape the heart tube. And there's an interplay between genetic factors like nodal and GREB1L and mechanical constraints like the buckling when the heart tube elongates between fixed poles, or the mechanical constraints when one part of the tube stops growing, and how this can affect ventricle position as models of two diseases, heterotaxy and the crisscross heart. So to finish, I want to thank in particular members of my lab who have been involved and performed the work that I've shown you today, in particular Jean-François Le Garec, who has developed the quantitative analysis of shape in 3D and the computer modeling of heart looping, Audrey Desgranges, who has performed the work on nodal mutants, and Ségolène Bernheim, who has performed the work on GREB1L mutants. Thank you very much.